I spotted lots of slides, so we'd better make a start and if he doesn't finish in 40 minutes, we just interrupt. The best Overman trick. Right, can I welcome Henry Overman? Henry's director of the Spatial Economics Research Centre here for the last 3 years, during which time he's turned from being an applied empirical spatial economist to somebody who spends too much time talking to ministers and senior civil servants about policy. I guess we're going to get something in between the two. So you'll find some of the plot of this on the blog that came out last week, yeah. I think, on the LSE website, the Spatial Economics website. It's going to talk about what should open policy do, lessons for London or lessons from London or maybe both?
Thank you very much for the invitation to talk. Yes, as Ian sort of hinted, I couldn't really decide what I was going to talk about. So I spent a big chunk of my life trying to persuade central government what it should be doing about urban policy. But I also spend some of my time talking to places like Manchester, where I sit on their economic advisory panel, about what the hell they should be doing. And I couldn't decide which way around to spin this, so I've just decided to sort of barge straight through the middle and just tell you some stuff that I think is interesting about urban policy. And you can see whether or not you think it's useful. So interesting, how useful it is, we'll find out. So let me tell you, let me just give you some broad background. The way in which I'm going to set this up is that I think that in our popular discourse around urban policy at the moment, we're getting ourselves in a bit of a mess. And we're getting ourselves in a mess because we have these conflicting objectives and we are not sort of willing to say which of them we really, you know, the policy objective that we really want to pursue. And I really think that discussions around London actually is where this sort of particularly manifests, but you'll get the idea that I think this sort of holds more generally. And so here's the conflict. I mean, we have this one story which says the economy is just, well, in the toilet, for want of a better way of putting it. So we've got to do something about growth. And cities, you know, are vital drivers of that, and they're going to contribute to it. Okay, so that's objective number one, says, look, what we've got to do with our cities is maximise economic growth. But then objectives number 2, 3, and 4 say, yes, but we want less financial services. We want geographic rebalancing, so we want the north to catch up with the south, and we want to reduce intra-city inequality. Okay, and on my rough take, all of these conflict with one another. Okay, now of course it's fine for policymakers to set up objectives, all of which conflict with one another, right? I mean, we do this all the time. But at some point, you need to take a punt on which of these is your primary objective. Okay, and I am basically going to argue that I think that this should be our primary objective. I am an economist after all, but I'm going to try and tell you how I've got there, which is really to tell you the story about how economists think about urban policy and then the lessons for London on some of these objectives, okay, which spell out how I've reached it, my sort of feeling for where we should be going. So it's going to be a rapid run through because I want to make sure we get to some policy. The outline of the thing is roughly as follows. I'm going to spend no more than a couple of minutes talking about the drivers of city performance to give you some feeling for my sort of overall macro perspective. I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking about the relative role of people versus place, something that people in this room, some of you will have heard me talk about before, but it's pretty important if you want to understand how I get at the policy implications that I the policy conclusions that I reach. I want to talk a little bit about the implications of well-being of spatial disparities, something which is horrifically badly understood, and then I want to get onto policy implications. And roughly speaking, you know, it's an academic seminar. I want to spend half the time actually giving us a framework for thinking about the things, and then half my time hammering through a bunch of policy recommendations. Okay, So those of you, you know, who like all the policy stuff, you've got to wait at least 20 minutes while we go through some deeper things, you know, some research and evidence before reaching our conclusions about what policy should do. I know that that's terribly controversial amongst some people, that we should have some idea how the economy works before we reach policy conclusions, but that's the academic in me. I can't help having that sort of order to things, okay? So, understanding cities. I'm not going to talk about this very much, okay? But my sort of broad brush framework, which will be important for later, has sort of two or three things being traded off when I think about cities, okay? The first is, and most of what we're going to talk about today, is cities as places of production, okay? So the sort of economic side of cities, places of production. And here, the fundamental thing that I have in my head is that for all kinds of reasons, wages and productivity are higher in cities. Okay, so that's basic thought number one that you need to sort of get if you want to understand how I think about cities. I also think about cities as places of consumption. All right, mostly because you get more choice in cities as a result of being able to spread fixed costs. I will touch a little bit on this, but not as much as some people in this room would. And then off trading these two benefits of cities is this big cost of cities. Okay, and the cost of cities come from the fact that there's lots of scarce resources, which are highly priced, and there's lots of other people around. And lots of other people around means that things are congested. And things being congested imposes costs in terms, really directly, of that congestion, but then also in the sense all these other negative externalities that having to be around lots of people throw up, crime, pollution, etc. Okay, so I think of cities as being a battle between these benefits and these costs. And that's a sort of broad framework. Now, you know, if you really want to understand what's been happening to our cities over recent years, I think this chart gives you a lot of it. What this chart does is basically rank stuff, industries, by how much they benefit from being in cities. Okay, and the further down this thing you go, the more you benefit from being in cities relative from being, you know, in pokey countryside, all right? And what you notice is, you know, here's the average of manufacturing, and then you have all these high-end services or high-tech stuff. Okay, and the more you go down this thing, you know, here's finance insurance, here's business and management consultants, da, 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 right? So this is a list of things. And what's been happening recently in the UK and other places, is the structure of the economy has been shifting us down this list, and as we shift down this list, cities have become more important. Okay, so if I want to understand the resurgence of cities that we've seen around the world, a big chunk of it is that we've been shifting towards service activities that benefit more from being in cities. All right, so that's your sort of broad brush picture, history, urban economics 101. Now, you know, a lot of the way I think about this is, all right, well, what's going to happen to UK cities and the way we think about policy? Quite a lot of these things are going to be stuff that we have very little control over, actually, because as the structure of the UK economy changes, you know, we start doing different things, the sort of structure of cities are going to change. So some of this stuff is sort of driven by what's going on in the global economy. We can come back and touch on that. But there are some things that policy can do on that sort of side of things, on how cities work, on the economy side of things. Actually, though, from a policy perspective, I think far more of the things that we can really do in terms of, you know, our day-to-day policy all come on the cost side of that equation. The benefit side of it is very difficult for governments to do things about. The cost side, it's incredibly easy for us to do stuff on the cost side, and I'm going to suggest that a lot of what we do is very bad. Okay, so a lot of what policymakers do in terms of urban policy is actually to do stuff that they think is about, you know, how the economy works, but is absolutely, you know, has no impact on it, while absolutely screwing up how things work on the cost side of that thing in a way that's very bad for cities. Okay, and then later on I'll touch on issues of uneven performance. So let me give you some evidence. I don't need to show this. So I'm going to do this in the UK context, and I want to give you a feeling for what economic performance looks like in the UK, okay, and what's driving it. So the first thing that I want to tell you is that area disparities in Britain are incredibly persistent, okay? So Here's a simple picture that does that. I've taken average wage in 1998, okay, for cities, and here's average wage in Britain, and then where you are here says where you are relative to that average wage in 1998, and here is average wage in 2008, a decade later. Okay, after the Labour government in Britain had invested a huge amount of energy in addressing area disparities. Okay, what have they achieved? What you can see they've achieved is absolutely nothing. Okay, because this here is a 45 degree line that shows what would have happened if in 1998 you just maintained your relative position up to 2008. Okay, and roughly speaking, you know, you sit on this thing. And what they had, you know, some of these, you probably can't see this, but for those of you that know the geography of Britain, you know, some places like Hartlepool, you know, just slip further and further behind is what we've achieved at the bottom of the distribution, all right? But generally speaking, we achieved nothing. The places that were at the top at the beginning, still at the top at the end, and the relative distribution hasn't changed at all, okay? Now, by the way, don't get me wrong, these disparities might have been much worse in the absence of policy intervention. That I can tell you relatively little about. But what I can tell you is that a big amount of effort has achieved very little in terms of shifting around these area disparities in Britain. Now, do I care about that? Well, one of the things that when you look at a picture like that, you've really got to understand is that there is a difference between these raw area disparities, just average wage of places, okay? There's a difference between that and area effects. Now, what do I mean by area effects here? When I say area effect, I have in mind the thought experiment of moving people in this room around the place and seeing what it does to their wage, okay? So this is a thought experiment that says, look, I'm currently living in Liverpool, would I be better off if I moved to London? Okay, or in my specific example, I grew up in Folkestone. For those of you that don't know it, it's safely down the bottom side of that picture. Now, you know, how much better off am I as a result of the fact that I got decent A-level grades and escaped from horrible Folkestone? Okay. Now, this is important, okay, because this gives you some idea for how much better off we can make people by shifting them around the place. Okay. Because it gives you a feeling for how much of the disparities that we see are to do with people versus how much of the disparities that we see are to do with places. Okay, and that's what I'm trying to spit out here. Now, you can make area disparities in Britain look colossally big. Okay, so here is a thought experiment of let's take the average wage in the worst place in Britain and compare it to the average wage in the best place in Britain. Okay. What's the difference? 67%. Okay, so a favourite way of making statistics look big is to compare extremes. Okay, now let me already do something that gives you a feeling for the fact that those area effects are not as important as you think by saying let's, instead of taking the two absolute extremes, let's take the 90th percentile and the 10th percentile. So let's rank everywhere, look at somewhere that's in the top, around about the top 10%. Somewhere that's around about 90%, there moving from the 90th to the 10th percentile, you would see about a 26% change in wages. Now let's do 75 to 25%, you see about an 11% change. Okay, so this is the change in average wages as we move across things. So spatial disparities in Britain, they are pretty persistent, but taking the extremes make them look much, much bigger than they really are. Okay, narrowing in, and already those disparities don't look quite as big. Now that's what this column tries to convince you of. The comparison between here and here says, hold on though, I'm still muddling up composition, the fact that, you know, London is chock full of skilled people, I'm muddling up that effect with just sort of broad area differences between places. What about the thought experiment of what happens when we follow that person moving? Okay, and what happens to their wage? Well, I can tell you that really has a remarkable effect. Okay, if you look at someone like me moving from Folkestone to London, or Hartlepool, because I know Hartlepool's at the bottom, so there we go, Hartlepool to London, all right,
I would see 16% increase in wage. That's not nothing, but it's a hell of a lot smaller than the 67% that comes from comparing averages. Okay, why? Because Hartlepool, you know, I hate to say it, it's full of low skilled people that would earn low wages wherever they were. London is full of high skilled people who would earn high wages wherever they are. Once you take out that effect, moving seems to do less. And then look, here's that same trick I did of saying, let's not take the extremes, let's take the kind of moves, you know, that actually the vast majority of people are going to make. 90th to 10th percentile, 7%, 75th to 25th percentile, you get 4% increase in wage. Now, these things are not irrelevant, right? In a world where we are seeing 0% wage increases, you know, 4% sounds like a lot, right? But still, they are much, much smaller than you would expect. So, how do you reconcile these sort of small area effects with big differences in average wages? Reconcile it, I've hinted at it, because people sort. Okay? So here is something that just measures what wage you would obtain anywhere. Okay? And here is something that plots how important the place is in terms of when I move to a place, does it pay me high wages? And what do you notice? Well, you notice that London, yes, you get a higher wage than you would located in other places. You also happen to be incredibly able. You put the combination of those two things together, you get big measured disparities. All right? By the way, for those of you that are keeping up here and clutching at straws, you might say, oh my goodness, all right, so labour, we're actually targeting the area effect, right? The underlying performance of the economy. They can't do much about sorting. It turns out they can't do much about area effect either, okay? Because, you know, this again, London here is basically unmoved. There's a little bit more mobility. Not much. So basically, you know, when I look at area disparities in Britain, I can make them look as big as I want. I can also make them look incredibly small. For us today, the important thing to cling on to is the fact that most of the area disparities that we see in Britain are driven by who you are, not where you are. Most, not all. Where you are does matter. Okay, so that's stylized fact number one to take away with you, all right? When you're thinking about spatial disparities and you're thinking about what policy should do, just remember that a lot of the spatial disparities we see, they're just driven by the sorting of people with different skills. Nothing to do with underperformance of the Blackpool economy, etc., etc. All right? So, that's fact number one. Fact number two, real disparities in quality of life. What time do I start? 25 to 22? All right. Real disparities in quality of life. So look, should you care about those area effects still, right? I've told you there's sorting going on. I've told you that the best people tend to live in the better places. Should we care about that? Now, as an economist, when I try to answer the question, should we care about that, I like to think about real quality of living, okay? Well-being, rather than just the wage that people earn. Why? Well, because I told you that I tend to think about, you know, the benefits of places, big benefits of big cities being partly offset by costs. All right? And you know, let me just put it on the table. Deep down, I don't actually care that much if people in London earn higher nominal wages, but it just all goes on housing. All right? If I'm really trying to understand the implications of these area disparities of people's well-being, I want to think in terms of real incomes. So incomes once I take away those housing costs. And I'm going to give you a picture which just shows you what happens in Britain. Okay. So here is my pay, net of taxes, depending on where I live. All right. And here is my housing cost, depending on where I live. Right. And you see London here? This is incredibly high pay, we saw that, right? But, I mean, as we all know, living in this room, it's also high housing cost, okay? This line here is the one-for-one line that explains, that would basically give you what where everything would sit if housing costs were just moving to offset living wage differences.
I mean, what do you see? I mean, you see that, as we all know in this room, living in London is colossally expensive relative to the wage you get. In other words, London pays a lower real wage. I can't find Hartlepool. Here's Hartlepool. So London pays a lower real wage than Hartlepool. Okay? In Hartlepool, actually relative to the cost of living, you earn more than you do in London relative to the cost of living. You notice the red ones here are the cities. You see it really, really goes up incredibly steeply, cost of living, in our more successful cities. Okay, and this is basically, you know, you can see where I'm going to go here in terms of urban policy. Policymakers really can't do very much here. They can do a hell of a lot here. Okay, and what we do in Britain is pull levers that make these better places colossally expensive. Okay. I worry about the disparities. In fact, I still don't worry about the disparities I'm showing you here, by the way. Because, deep down, I think that most of us living in London are choosing to be here. And then the fact that we get low real wages means we must be getting something else that compensates us for it. Otherwise, I'd move. So basically, no one in this room, is allowed to whinge to me about the cost of living in London relative to the cost of relative to the wages you get, because we've all chosen to be here. So this is not a room for that complaint. Okay. Yep.
Can you give us a sense what the scale means?
Oh well, so net pay about 1.5 times higher, equivalent housing costs about 4 times higher. Is roughly what that means. Okay. Roughly. 1.5 times higher than average. So let me tell you the lessons and then start to get it a bit more towards policy. Who you are, much more important than where you live. You understate the cost of high wage places if you ignore the sorting of workers, that's for sure. I mean, one of the reasons why London looks incredibly expensive is it's full of very well paid people who consume lots of housing. Okay. Controlling for all of this makes high wage places look very expensive. For Britain, cities' costs rise way more than one for one with earnings. I think this is a very bad thing, I should say. The high quality of living places are predominantly southern and irrelevant for today's talk, but rural and nice bits of the coast. Okay. So, by the way, just in case it comes up later, you know, if you think that my statement that nearly everything is driven by people and place at the people rather than place at the city level sort of puts me on the extreme. You should hear me on neighbourhoods. Okay, I pretty well think that for the vast majority of neighbourhoods, where you are is completely irrelevant. Okay, and the reason for that is that people are really mobile within cities. So the vast majority of neighbourhood disparities, I think, come from the sorting of people. If you were to push me, I would say absolutely in the very, very worst social housing areas characterised by high percentage of social housing, where people aren't mobile, you can get very, very bad area effects. Okay? But for the vast majority of the population for whom we're setting urban policy, it's sorting, not place, within cities. Okay? In the interest of time, I'm not putting up pictures that try and convince you of this. Okay? So let me get to urban and regional policy. Now imagine you're a policymaker confronted with this. Right? We've got places are different, people are sorting, who you are more important than where you are, but where you are matters. Now let's take the traditional urban and regional policy perspective. The traditional urban and regional policy perspective says, can't do anything about sorting. This is wrong, of course, you knew lots of things about sorting, but the traditional thing says can't do anything about sorting, so I'm still going to try and tackle those area effects. So part three of my story says, you might wish you could, but you can't. Policy is incredibly bad at tackling those underlying area disparities, okay, those underlying area effects. Let me just give you a couple of examples. I won't go through this too much, but here's something called the Local Enterprise Growth Initiative, LEGI. All right, appalling acronym. Where's that? Barking and Dagenham. Here's the LEGI boundary.
Okay, here, let's go in here, let's invest a whole bunch of money because Barking and Dagenham has bad area effects. Let's go in, invest a whole bunch of money, pull that, you know, release its energy and power and all of this kind of empowerment stuff, right? Let's see, you know, drive it up. All right, so let me tell you what happens if you do that. Here is what happens before this policy is in place. As you move from the centre of these leggy zones out to where that leggy boundary is and then beyond that boundary, okay? So what I'm doing here is basically comparing areas that are inside these boundaries in terms of their employment to areas outside. You see there's not really much difference between them, except for the fact that, you know, these areas are doing slightly worse on employment before, which is presumably why we come along and give them this leggy policy, okay? Let's see what spending millions and millions of pounds does. What spending millions and millions of pounds does is the following. It shifts employment from 500 metres outside of the leggy area to 500 metres inside the leggy area. Okay, you notice that this is flat, this is flat. This is the change in growth after I introduce a leggy policy. Up 500 metres inside the boundary, down 500 metres outside. Okay. I like to refer to this as the shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic policy of urban development. Okay, we're just shifting stuff across a boundary. We're spending £80 a resident to achieve this fantastic outcome in terms of employment. Okay, these policies do nothing for employment rates amongst local people. Why? Because people commute more than 750 metres. Okay? Just basically shift stuff across the boundary. Well, you know, there are other policies we could look at. Here's a single regeneration budget. This one I just flag up because it talks to one of my favourite obsessions about shiny buildings, okay? The single regeneration budget effectively, it didn't spend all this money, but effectively it resulted in the British public and government spending £5 billion on commercial space in deprived neighbourhoods. This one is actually worse than leggy in the sense that we can detect no effect on employment. This doesn't even shift stuff 750 metres. Okay, this basically provides some shiny buildings. All right. Now look, though, you know, I'll come back to this a little bit later. I can personally live with the shiny building side of the policy in terms of, you know, public goods and cost, etc. I'm just trying to tell you that it does nothing on employment. Okay. But interestingly, there is something that goes on here in employment rates, but it's nothing to do with the shiny buildings. It's all to do with the other stuff that this policy does, like going in and addressing people's skills and trying to do after school clubs and stuff that targets local people. Regional selective assistance, for those of you that say, well, what about if we went and gave money to businesses instead of firms? Actually, that's the one thing you can do to drive up employment in these areas, okay, in a way that is genuinely additional, is going to give large amounts of money to firms. You don't want to give it to big firms, you need to give it to small firms, and you need to give it to small firms producing tradable stuff. It's no use giving it to hairdressers, then you get the effect that you did with leggy. But if you give it to small, medium-sized manufacturing firms who are exporting to China, then you can push up employment. Now, what's the problem with this policy? The problem with this policy is that it has no impact on productivity, and the firms you give money to tend to be low productivity firms. So regional selective assistance is a mechanism for increasing employment at low productivity firms. Right? You see how there's a trade-off here? You can't, you know, generally speaking, guys that need financial assistance are not the productive powerhouses of the economy. I, by the way, think this applies as much to banks and auto producers as it does to people receiving RSA. So that's just a quick run through to say it's really hard to do things on the productivity side to try and address those area effects. It's really, really hard as a policymaker to do stuff that impacts positively in terms of improving productivity and performance in areas that you target.
So let's flip it round now and say, what about on the cost of living side? Are there things we can do on the cost of living side? Okay. Do we have policy levers that can have any kind of impact on cost of living? We do, and we pull them all in such a way as to massively drive up the cost of living, to the great detriment of the vast majority of the British public. Okay. So let me just give you the background for those of you that don't know. Here is annual average real house price growth, 1970 to 2006. So this is each year. You'll notice that Germany manages zero. Switzerland, which is a rich, vastly developing country with very, very tight land constraints, manages 0.5% per year. Britain manages 4.5 percentage points per year. Okay, this is a spectacular achievement, but not of the good kind. All right? Even Spain managed less. All right? And pick anywhere. I mean, the Netherlands, small and crowded, 3.5%. Right? I mean, we have managed to achieve spectacularly fast housing price growth. Why? Because of the planning system. So, in Britain, if you took the most restrictive planning system and relaxed it to be roughly the average, you would decrease house prices by about 35%. Now, this is just a relative effect. Okay, I can't actually tell you what the aggregate effect of doing that would be. Okay, this is just a relative effect. Most restrictive to average, 35%. Britain's a really crowded country. We can't all fit in. It's awful, you know. The southeast is full. Migrants go home. Fine. That would explain about 10 percentage points. Okay, so this is, planning is much, much more serious than the lack of developable land. And if it's because you think Britain is incredibly hilly, that explains about 3 percentage points. Okay, so there is some effect from the fact that we built a lot, you know, we built some stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, for those of you that don't know the statistics, I mean, Britain was built on about 7% of its developable land. So developable land, I mean, yes, so we built on more of it in places where people want to live, so it does prevent, you know, it does provide some constraint. But the vast majority is house prices. This ignores general effects. It's just talking about the relative, and it ignores things like the effect on the size of housing and all of these kind of things that Alan has so carefully documented in the past. So we can do really bad things on planning. Now, what about if you're pro-business? You don't care about housing. Housing's boring. George Osborne, you know, only cares about commercial development. Here, here is something that gives you a feeling for just quite how much of a tax the planning system imposes on commercial space. This is from Cheshire and Hilbert, the Economic Journal, 2008. What this does is it just looks at how much more you pay for floor space than it costs the construction industry to provide it to you. Okay, so London West End, you pay about 800% premium on what it would cost the real estate industry to provide you with more space. That's going up, by the way, of course. Right? It's 488% in the City of London. It's 327% in Canary Wharf. For those of you that say, "Oh yes, but you know, we've got to have all of this stuff in place because it keeps, you know, the centre of our cities beautiful. It's about constraints on the amount of land, etc., etc." Paris, the city, manages 300% as opposed to our 800%. Manhattan manages naught. Okay, and last time I checked, that was a pretty popular place for people to go and visit. So, why is this? I mean, because we're constraining the supply of commercial office space. Let me just do retail and then let me switch focus to the policy objectives. Here, for those of you that haven't seen it, is supermarket productivity in Britain, depending on the time at which the store was built. Okay, so here's 1966, pre-Walmart, you know, back in the days where we really didn't know how to ship stuff around or, you know, how to do productivity. And here's a measure of how productive we are. And then, you know, here comes IT and containerization and shipping, etc., etc. Oh, and here comes town centre first policy, which spectacularly has managed to reverse all of the productivity gains that we had achieved in the retail sector between 1966 and 1986 when the policy was introduced, so that our supermarkets...
Sorry, it was 1996, it wasn't
86. The first major restriction on supermarkets are 86,
right? Town Centre first?
Town Centre first was with John Donnelly in 1996.
Oh, hmm. Okay.
86, then we gave the commission for
Bluewater. 86, what, sorry?
Bluewater, 86.
Well, that's probably you. So that's Bluewater, and then fine. All right, somewhere between here and here, we introduced Town Centre First policy.
Can I ask about the scale? It was 13.58 and 13.67. They aren't very different.
So here's the... All right. So here's the estimate. Here's the real number that you want. So if you take these things and assume that annual productivity growth would have kept on growing, why not? It has done in the United States. And then you look at a store built in 2006 post the introduction of Town Centre First policy. It's about 16% on productivity, retail productivity. Okay, is what that amounts to. So. I mean, if you just come from here to here, it doesn't look so big, but it's if you, you know, take that trend out to about here, which is not unreasonable. I mean, we actually, you know, that's probably being conservative, because most of the evidence that we have from Walmart in the United States suggests that supermarket productivity, you know, went through the roof if we allowed big places. So anyhow, it's very bad. So... It's very hard to change area effects. It's much easier for policy to affect costs. All right, this is the story that I've tried to tell you. So, who you are, more important than where you are. Deep down, for the vast majority of mobile people, I don't particularly care where you are in terms of trying to understand differences in real quality of living. If I was thinking about economic policy, to try and tackle area effects. Let's go in, you know, one policy option, let's bring those worst places up. I think you're really gonna struggle, okay? What I think you can do is really drive up costs. And where do we really drive up costs? We tend to drive up costs most in the places that were better. By the way, I should say, and this is something that's only really I've become convinced of recently, I think the place might look slightly more important than it does in terms of driving disparities if it wasn't for the fact that policy in Britain has so incredibly constrained the growth of our more successful places, so they haven't been able to build on that critical mass. Either way, what we do in Britain is price people out of areas and spend a lot of time trying to bring up the worst areas by spending a lot of money that has almost no impact. That's roughly speaking my take on it. So, I said that this would be completely uncontroversial. I hope that's true. So let me just spend 5 minutes and then stop. So,
Henry, can you just take it back to the previous slide? You've got a transport mentioned there, which I think I probably agree with, but you haven't touched on it, is it?
That's just because Christine looked at my slides and said you've got way too many slides there, and I cut it out. Remind me of the questions. Remind me of the questions. Once I've finished, I can come back and talk about that, okay? If you're interested, if people are interested. It basically comes off of going back and looking at every major road investment that we made in Britain in the last decade and looking at whether or not we can detect any productivity impact on firms that are sited near to those improved transport networks, and finding nothing. I mean, the one thing it does do, as you'd expect, is employment moves slightly towards those places that are now better connected. Which you would completely expect, because you're providing public good that allows it. So, it's much easier for policy to affect costs. So, I mean, fine, what do you do? Right. If that's the background of the way you think about urban policy, what are the things I say to government? All right. Probably horrified. Many of you will probably be just horrified that I have any influence on government as a result of this. But believe me, I'm in a minority. I'm in a minority.
Evidence is there.
So I have a minority. Yes, so, but you and me both, Tim. Limited impact. I have to say, every time I'm in the room, I'm probably in a minority of one in thinking about it this way. So let me tell you. So what do you do? Right, so you're now thinking about policy, urban policy making. I mean, you're either London thinking about what you should do, or you're, you know, Greg Clark thinking, right, what should I do for cities in this country? If you're London, ask for more powers. I haven't touched on this, and the reason why I haven't touched on this is absolutely no evidence that devolution of powers will help growth, okay, on the economic side of the policy. I should balance this out by saying there's no evidence that it won't help growth. I'm just completely neutral on the devolution of powers. My personal... okay, I'm completely neutral on it from the point of view of growth. My personal position, which I suspect probably would be reasonably well agreed with in this room, is that there's plenty of theoretical reasons to think that localisation needs a good local government, and I think that's a pretty positive thing. Okay, experimentation, fit to local needs, etc., etc. Right? So I'm reasonably comfortable with us trying localisation. Why not? We've tried lots of centralisation. I'm not saying that's worked brilliantly, so why not? If I was really London, I wouldn't be worried particularly about asking for more powers. If I was Manchester, I wouldn't be worrying particularly desperately about asking for more powers. The thing I would be fundamentally worrying about at the moment is making sure that I came out of the local government finance review well, which Tony will be talking about in a couple of weeks' time. But, you know, it's all... this is where everything is to play for. We can talk about that in a minute. I would reform land use planning. It's pretty clear, you know, I mean, I've made the case for this. I would basically... look, I fully understand there's a trade-off between localism versus growth here. Okay? It's just that I tend to come down on the side of the dispossessed in this particular policy area and think that we just shouldn't allow people who happen to be wealthy enough to live in the best parts of Britain to price the rest of us out of them. Okay? By using the land use planning system. I would. It's not just on housing. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things around mixed use, brownfield, town centre first. What do I? You know, actually, I'm reasonably sympathetic. I must be in an unusual position here. I'm reasonably sympathetic with what the government are trying to do in terms of decentralising and providing local incentives to local communities in Britain to take the money. Despite the fact that I would like to see more building, and I think that decentralisation is going to lead to less. Okay? So I know there's a few other people in the room who feel this way. So I agree with the policy, I just don't think the incentives are going to be large enough. So I agree with the objectives, just the implementation worries me slightly. If I was going to be more radical, I would do land auctions in a serious way, and I would drop town centre first policy. I've got a horrible feeling that because that one is so interesting to only a few nerdy people and Mary Portis and all these other people on the other side, that you know these town centre first policies are going to stay in place and possibly... They were slightly watered down in the reforms that we've seen today, and I think that's going to be an easy thing for the coalition government to give great adoption. Okay, so Olympics legacy, let me briefly touch on that. If I was London, I can't get too excited. I mean, for me, the Olympics just fits in my shiny building syndrome. Okay, I know lots of people in this room are probably terribly excited about it. I view it as a colossally expensive way of providing some shiny buildings in East London. I think it'll have absolutely no impact, beneficial or otherwise, on the local people. Why? Because local people sort. So even if we do sort out the basket case that is the East London economy, what will happen? House prices and rent will go up. Poor people will be forced to go somewhere else in the city that doesn't work quite as well. Okay. This might be a good way of getting in space, ports facilities, sports facilities, some housing, but it's absolutely nothing to do with helping poor people. And I suspect that other than through some minor impacts from this stuff, it's nothing to do with helping the London economy. Doesn't necessarily say I'm against it, but you know, as a piece of economic development, I just think it's a complete red herring. Transport, I touched on this a little bit. I mean, what would I do if I was in charge of transport? That's another one that I...
have been asked about and achieved remarkably little influence on, you'll be pleased to know. I would basically make my decisions on transport based on reasonable projections about what the policy might achieve. Okay, which would seem like a modest objective, but one that is incredibly hard to influence in government. It's very, very hard to do stuff that influences areas through transport policy. You can do stuff, but if you do it, rents go up, poor people get pushed out. So it's not at all of social policy, it's at all of transport policy and public good provision. You should just make the decisions based on that. So I don't care about social deprivation objectives of transport, because I think every time we do something to tackle social deprivation, people sort around it and muddle us up. I'm pretty consistent with this, by the way. I think one of the worst things we could do in London is improve the public transport links to Hackney. Okay, I think we should leave Hackney as a public transport, as a bus heaven and a tube black spot. Okay. Whilst I'm more radical, just because I have to say it every time I talk to anyone, we should scrap high speed too. That's clearly a no-brainer. And we should use the £33 billion that it releases for all of the high-impact schemes within London and other cities that we've already got on the books and that we know would make a much bigger difference. You know, it all sounds horrible, right? I mean, I sound like a really, you know, right-wing radical, we should do nothing. Actually, I just think we should be realistic about what policy should achieve. Let me do this within London. But the way I would be realistic within London is to say, look, some areas of London are better than others, and there's pretty well nothing I can do about it as a policymaker in terms of the performance of their economy. Because most of that's to do with people, not place, and changing those place effects is just incredibly difficult. So, you know, what do? I say, well, look, you know, I think about what I'm doing in London. There's lots of it about public good provision, etc. And I focus investment, if I really have to, on places that have the potential to create private sector jobs. And then I either build housing or offices in those places, or if not, I hope that poorer people can commute to them. By the way, my more radical thing on focusing spending is to get the government to scrap the regional growth fund, or at least take the word growth out of it. You know, it's either or, right? It's either a growth fund or it's a regional fund. I don't mind which of these two you want it to be, but let's have some clarity. If you want it to be a growth fund, I would take £2 billion and spend them on the best projects in terms of return. You know, you might be horrified by this, but it's because I think that area differences are mostly driven by sorting, and I care about people, not place. Okay. So I think policy should focus on and be assessed by its impact on people, not places, and that much of what we do in urban and regional policy is just far too focused on turning around declining places, which we actually have almost no ability to do, and has paid very, very little attention to individuals. If you really want to push me, my feeling, the evidence-based tells us, is that at the individual level, we need interventions as early as life as possible. Preschool, if not primary school. And later in life, the evidence tells us that the most cost-effective interventions are on the side of the labour market, which is basically encouraging labour market activity and removing barriers to mobility. You know, this really, that's probably alienated the last person in the room that might have agreed with everything I said to date, because I know that Tim is not particularly pro some of the stuff we're doing on labour market policy. So, you know, what do you have if you do it like this? What you have is you accept the fact that you can't do much about those underlying area disparities. You accept the fact that actually you shouldn't worry too much, but what you should be trying to do is shift the population to the better bits of the country. You don't worry about any of this because really you care about the impact on people, not places. I've talked about some of the ways you could achieve this in practice. If you went away with one message from the whole thing, it would be that policy should be focused on people, not places. And look, I'm a realist. Here's my disclaimer, right? This is not a view shared by pretty well any constituency-based policymaker. I'll stop there and take some questions.
Right, thank you. I think there's not much room for questions, I guess. I'll see you a promised one then.
No, I think.
Can we say who you are?
Martin Crookston, formerly on the Urban Task Force, so guilty of many of the charges already laid. My question was actually about the transport impact, which I think Henry by and large covered it. It's the A55 effect, isn't it, in North Wales? You build this shiny new road and it's going to lead to lots of new jobs in North Wales. It doesn't, it sucks them all back to depots in Chester. So now they can serve the whole bloody area from Chester. So I'm with you on that. I mean, I think that if I start with the bottom one, that was what I was most interested in. I think that what you're sort of doing is pricing current policy, aren't you, in terms of the damage you're finding in terms of growth and effects on people. And in a way, it's what you need, what we need to do is say, well, we're not going to get all those changes. The British planning system is maybe going to change quite a bit, but it's going to change anything like the amount measured by the on-off sort of tests. Mm-hmm. So the question really is, where do you get the benefits? Is it about, actually, allowing Cambridge to grow, to dump, whilst recognising that it doesn't matter so much, you quite a lot of other places don't, where the economy would like to, but you've got a set of environmental choices as well. And I think that's the areas I find difficult and complex, but I think where we go next with a lot of this, what this is telling us is the costs of what we do at the minute. But those, the things that we do are, a lot of them are the product of the English at least deciding that that is how they want to run things.
So you see, so yeah, I am somewhat sympathetic with that. The only thing I would say is that I don't think the vast majority of people do know that these are the sort of magnitudes of costs that we are talking about. You know, imagine that instead of the National Trust, you know, imagine we had some other organisation than the National Trust, right, with millions of members, that was about lobbying to protect the poor in the same way as the National Trust lobby to protect the countryside, right? They would have just had a remarkably effective campaign, getting the public to lobby British ministers because decisions made by our policymakers, you know, increase our cost of housing by 50%, conservative estimate, increase our cost of shopping by 20%, increase the cost of doing business if you are in offices, at least on the land side of things, which may be a 10, 50, you know, by 15%, right? You know, I just don't think people know. I just don't think people have any conception of the fact that the implications of these, the way we pull these policy levers is just quite such a dramatic impact on our cost of living. And the other thing, to bring you to your thing about trading off the environmental benefits, I mean, the other thing that I think people don't realise is just how appallingly crappy is the so-called countryside that we protect as a result of these things.
I mean, I'm
not
sure about that, Henry.
So I'm going to make this a precise statement. You know, we know from millions and millions of pounds that we have just spent doing this audit of the environmental and social value of our undeveloped land, that actually a lot of the stuff that we protect generates very, very small externalities that in no way could justify the price differences that we see for those pieces of land. So, you know, we've got land in intensive agricultural production where our estimates of the amenity value of that put it, you know, £20,000-£50,000 per hectare, and we got price differences of £1 million. So don't get me wrong, you know, it's completely important actually for, you know, for protecting all that stuff that people really care about. And I wouldn't want to get rid of those bits of it, right? But, you know, there is just some of the stuff that's protected is very crappy. And I actually think, you know, it's interesting because I need to be a bit careful on how I say this, but policymakers who made the decision, for example, on retaining town centre first in the National Planning Policy Framework, had no estimate of the cost of that policy presented to them before making that decision. So I don't think it's factored in.
Michael.
I enjoyed your talk very much. half of your recommendations and the other half I think were complete rubbish. And I'm trying to disentangle in my mind how to make a helpful intervention. I think I want to concentrate on two things. One is that I think there's a missing analysis.
Can you say who you are?
Michael Edwards, UCL. There's a missing bit in
planning school.
Let's take the office case, the poor Cheshire argument that you pay 800% premium for space in the West End, whatever it is, 500% in the city, compared with what it would cost to add more floors to those buildings if the construction of the development industry was allowed to do it. Now, if you relax the planning system to permit all those extra, I'm absolutely sure they wouldn't be built. And the reason they wouldn't be built is that we've got a land ownership of the real estate development set, which has got used to certain kinds of values, has got used to certain kinds of rents. Indeed, so keen on it that it drives the yields down to very low level. They certainly aren't going to mess that up by large scale ability to drive the price of it. Equally, I think that housing people would probably agree that if you, well, there's a lot of work on this, that if you relax all the kind of controls on residential building land, the developers would not come forward and suddenly decide they were mass production companies or new firms would enter the market to do that, and would get a huge flood of house building that would bring prices down. I think we have got to, in order to achieve the kinds of things which you want and I want, like housing, we've got to break the power of all these landowners and real estate sector interests. That seems to be terribly important. I don't suppose you would persuade Whitehall people to do that. That's the first question. Mm-hmm. Second is, suppose we take the perspective of the people who you admit do very, very badly actions. That is, the people who are low skilled people living wherever they live. Don't you think it's a really high priority to try and get those wages up? To get that low pay up, because then firms have an incentive to improve productivity. And to stop governments from subsidising low paid work through things like tax credits, and now we're told that supermarkets can get labour for nothing from the job sector.
Yeah. One is that you really missed out the real estate and landowning sector as a tremendously restrictive force on the second. So let's separate your first one to short term versus long term. I think of the structure of the British development sector as being an outcome of the system that we have in place. I am sure that you are absolutely correct that in the first, in fact, I can tell you that the people who are most opposed to ending town centre first nowadays will be CB Richard Ellis and any one of another dozen commercial property owners that you could name that have a large vested interest in artificially maintaining the property values downtown. So, in the short run, you know, industrial structure as it is, and whatever, you know, it might take some time. But, you know, but in the longer run, I just hate to sound like a real economist on this, but I just generally think that the structure of our real estate industry is predominantly driven by the planning restrictions that we have in place. I mean, it's the planning restrictions that make Tesco a commercial land broker with a sidearm in retail in Britain, right? I mean, they're not that anywhere else in the world, right? In the rest of the world, they're predominantly a retail firm. It's only in Britain that they're hugely distorted towards banking, land, etc., etc. So my take on that, I'm sympathetic, but I think in the longer run, these are competitive industries which people can enter. And competitive pressures will, in the longer run, mean that we would get the sort of supply response that I envisage here. Of course we're not going to get it if we don't free up land. So there's number one. Number two, it's difficult. Look, you know, what are any of the mainstream government, what are any of the mainstream parties willing to do to counter the two fundamental trends that have driven down low wages in this country, right? One of those is globalization, right, and the rise of China and the BRICS more generally, and the other of those is technological change. No government is going to do much to try and offset these two things. I think, you know, we can try to do stuff on the supply side of, you know, these policies, but I suppose sort of putting myself in that, you know, let's be realistic here. Given that I don't think we're going to do anything. Technology, globalization, technological change, globalization, or the planning system. I'm just banking on the fact that we might be able to do something about the planning system and we could do nothing about the other two. Okay? And then, you know, all right, fine. What's the other thing I would do? I've said that, actually. I mean, you know, I would really be investing a hell of a lot more in trying to get skill levels up at the lower end of the skill distribution, because I think that's the policy that has some capacity to have an impact on these things. So I think we disagree.
Really?
I mean,
we agree. It's just that I would put it on skills, because I don't think trade restrictions or sort of Ludditean technology policies are coming into place.
Emma, Nancy, Tony.
Emma Duncan from The Economist. I know it's not one of the main aims of the planning system. I do very much agree with you generally, but Ireland and Spain have relatively flexible planning systems compared to ours, and the housing building boom that they ended up with hasn't done them much good. And I think our economic problems would be even greater than they are now had we been able to cover our pretty areas with the sort of hideous building that they have done over the last 10 years.
I'm fairly alright. I have some sympathy for that, but we don't need to be Vegas, Spain, or Ireland in terms of our built. You know, heaven forbid we could be Switzerland. You know, just anything pushing us in the direction of travel. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, Spain and Ireland make it difficult. But the thing I can tell you about the US is that price volatility in Britain, on average, has been higher than the most volatile market in the US, which is Los Angeles. Now, you know, Vegas, you know, that might now suddenly, you know, put us somewhere above. That might put, you know, that one US market somewhere above. But don't, you know, house prices in Britain are actually spectacularly volatile. So, you know, would we be better or worse off if we had some construction thing? You know, I don't. As we were discussing the other day, you know, we're building 100,000 houses a year with a population of 60 million. You know, my modest ambition might be to get that up to 150,000 through changes in the planning reform. I don't think this is going to cause us a problem. Right, you know, by the way, of course, that's not what we need. We need much bigger numbers than that. But, you know, just realistic about what we're going to get. We're talking about changes at the margin here, I'm afraid to say, because none of this is going to happen. So I don't feel too bad arguing for the extreme, knowing that the outcome is going to be a little change like that. Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
And you had the Spain Yep. Yeah,
okay. Switzerland and Germany on one side, and you had, of course, us on the other side. And some things in the middle that I can't see at all because I'm too short.
Okay.
I'm wondering, I mean, you put this down to a story of planning being a problem, but I'm wondering as well what you think about the role of actual very easy credit played in all of this, because it strikes me that both Germany and Switzerland have rather tight credit markets, whereas we were pretty much lending anybody anything for any reason and dividing it all up and selling it off as CDOs and making finance quite happy. So I'm just not sure if the whole story can be explained by regulation.
I think that's a reasonable point. So here's the USA.
They were pretty liberal, right? I don't know if you can see that. Here's the USA, right? So, you know, look, despite many claims to the contrary, I basically think about the housing market as working with a demand curve and a supply curve. And, you know, much of the house, you know, some of the house price growth that we're seeing here is being driven by increases in demand that have come about as a result of financial liberalisation. Would I rein some of that back in? Yes. Would it change the underlying problem? No. We've still got no supply response, right? So, you know, I don't know. Let's attribute, let me do something that is a bit glib, but let me attribute 2 percentage point real income housing price difference per year to our planning system. If I take America as being what you manage with a liberal planning system and financial reform, and then we've managed 4.5%. Let me just, you know, we've both reformed, we've very restrictive and demand. Let me just subtract those two and say it's 2.5% a year that I'll put down to the planning system. That's an example, you know, I'm just ballparking it. But yeah, for sure. You know, would I be more responsible on lending policy? I think that would be a completely reasonable thing to do. Would it solve the problem? No.
Somebody in the middle, I've lost track of.
Helena from UCL. I'm just curious, I understand your suggestion that policy should be people-based and not place-based. But in those graphs that you show, you have a cluster of new towns at the very top, and it seems to indicate that they've actually done rather well and they're the product of a place-based policy of urban growth. So is that a coincidence, or...?
Yes. a more serious answer coming. Look, it's actually the new town. It's exactly a symptom of the kind of thing I'm calling for. You know, you take a part of the country which is doing reasonably well in terms of productivity, and you supply a whole bunch of housing in those places, and watch people sort of moving there. But is this Harlow you're thinking of? Right, some of this is just.
Stevenage.
Somewhere in there. Stevenage, and then the other ones, it's quite Crawley. Crawley.
Milton Keynes.
All right. So look, this. All right. So I don't really want to get into the. Let me try and. This is the pay that you can earn if you live there, and part of the reason why the pay in those places is so high is because they offer good access to the London economy. So if you did it on the pay that you would earn if you were in a firm in these places, it's partly a lot of what drives this, these guys being so high, is the fact that they give good access to London, and London pays very high wages. So it makes those places look like you could earn a high wage if you live there. So look,
it's a high quality of their culture.
No, it's actually just, if you come along and provide housing in reasonably successful parts of the country in reasonably large amounts, and then let people live there, that's a reasonably successful policy. What you won't be able to see on here is the Pathfinder areas, right? Go to areas which are completely doing awfully and provide them with net increases in their housing supply. Watch their house prices fall further. Right? Here we're just, you know, we've restricted the housing supply, we didn't allow anything to be built there, we now allowed stuff to be built there, people move there, they do fine.
To some extent, I mean, what I'm just, I mean, the new towns thing is perhaps going to take us too far away. I mean, what bothers me with the new towns is I just think it would probably be better to build quite a bunch of this housing on crappy bits of the greenbelt around the existing conurbations rather than sort of leapfrogging across the greenbelt so people commuted long distances. But, you know, second best world and all that. I can live with the growth poles.
Tony and Alan.
See, Tony, I mean, there are sort of two distinct parts to the argument, aren't there? One is about the planning system.
Yep.
And the one is about skills.
Mm-hmm.
These are two, although they're related in this talk, they're actually separate issues. On the planning system point, I mean, the difficulty is that all the economic rationality in the world, in the case of the planning system in this country, sort of runs headlong into a sort of aesthetic desire to protect the countryside. And so it's a rational thing running into something which you might say was less rational. Not everybody would say it like that, but less rational. And that aesthetic desire is reinforced by a fear for those who defend the countryside that if they let any of it, including what you call the crap bits, go, then it will just be the thin end of the wedge and the lot will go. So you're up against an aesthetic argument as if you were proposing selling off or burning the contents of the National Gallery for warmth. And on top of that, you know, then when we've done that, we'll do it with other things. So that's the first problem, that you're kind of using rationality and a sort of obvious frustration that nobody can understand the point when you're actually arguing an apples and pears argument. Because the people on the other side don't care about economic rationality, firstly. Second is, you say you'd spend the money on skills, and yet actually, in the last, certainly throughout the life of the last Labour government, far more money was spent on skills than was spent on all these sort of shiny new projects. Far more. Massive investment in education, a whole array of new programmes, schools relentlessly reformed, universities, more money, expanded, more and more people going into higher education, further education reformed and reformed, dozens of programmes. Yet at the end of all of that, skills apparently not to change, because none of this is altered, getting worse actually. So certainly unaltered. So if not that money on these schools, these skills initiatives, what money on what skills?
Yes, okay, so I don't know, we have to have one person saying, it's like Paul Cheshire and Alan Evans, for those of you that don't know, it's like they had to pass the baton on to someone to keep saying these things over and over and over and over again, just because there has to be someone out there saying it. I think we are getting better and better estimates of the cost impact of this, and I really, you know, decent estimates that we can point to saying these are the costs of this policy. And, you know, I think for all the reasons you say, you know, there's huge opposition to it, but I do think that, you know, just constantly pointing to the costs of policies is an important thing for academics to do. Now, I have, you know, I'm pretty realistic about the changes that will occur. I mean, this is why I say that you're trying to achieve things at the margin. I think actually the Labour got it right at the end. I mean, they realised that the supply constraints on housing actually were a really major issue and tried to do stuff with the regional plans. And actually, I do think, although, you know, I can quibble with what the coalition trying to do, you know, in terms of whether or not it will be an effective policy intervention, I actually think they have got the argument far earlier. So I think now there is a sense, if you look at Greg Clark, I think the big difference, for those of you that don't know, you know, Greg Clark is a sort of housing, he's cities minister. I at least think there are sort of ministers in government that you can point to who clearly have got it and are actually shedding quite a lot of political capital to try and do something about it. Now, whether they will stay the course, I don't know. Okay? But you know, relative to the cycle, we're at least engaged in the arguments earlier. Oh, the skills thing. Yeah, well, how depressed do you want me to get? Partly, the skills problem is that we spent too much of it on sodding shiny buildings and not enough of it on, you know, serious public sector reform that would allow us to fire bad teachers and get rid of them. You know, I'm really... I'm not a natural Tory supporter on some aspects of policy, but the one thing that I, you know, and Michael Gove probably is way out there in terms of money. But, you know, I think we invested a lot of money, you know, in improving school buildings, etc., etc. But actually, I'm not, you know, and I think that leaky roofs and all of that kind of stuff, you know, is a problem. But when you go past the building stock that we've put in place, it is clear that we spend actually a vast amount of this investment went on the physical capital side, rather than, and a lot of it went on wages for bad teachers, and bad, you know, bad people, and wage increases. So, you know, by the time you took out what we'd done on physical capital, and took out the average wage increases, a lot of which went to bad teachers, and bad university professors, etc., etc., you know, we all benefited from it, right? By the time you take those things out, actually, you know, I don't think the investment was that intelligent, maybe. All right, when I get really depressed, I just think there's absolutely nothing you can do. Because you know, when I get really, really depressed, I just think, let's imagine a world in which actually you need to take the skill distribution as roughly given. And that it's very, very hard to do anything about that in a reasonable length of time. And then, you know, that's probably for down the pub at 11 at night rather than here. But then I get really depressed. I mean, I just kind of feel if you're going to throw money away, you should throw it away trying to invest in people and trying to invest in skills. I'm being a bit glib. I mean, but we do have some...
But you must mean specifically disadvantaged people, doesn't it? Well, investing in skills in general is going to do nothing in relation to this, is it? Because you're starting off this people effect you're talking about is a very unequal distribution of assets which people bring to the labour market. So it reflects to where they came from.
It depends which objective you're trying to achieve. Relative to the days where I was a lefty student union officer campaigning against fees, for example, I am fairly comfortable with fees nowadays.
Right. But if you're trying to replace a spatial policy which was supposed to be spatially redistributive, the logic is that you have to press harder on a social policy, economic policy, which is individually redistributive.
Yes. I would like to see lots of skill investment in places down here, possibly with large redistributive transfers to fund it. Well, okay, no, you know, I should be careful. Because actually, I think London is chock full of people that are pretty... I mean, I would just basically like to see investment targeted down at the lower skill end of the distribution. Let me put it like that. The people, not the places.
Right, one at the back, yes.
Look, I think we should be funding these things out of general taxation, not out of some arbitrary set of restrictions on planning that have colossally negative consequences, and then justifying this because it allows us to extract some rents that then allow us to mitigate some of the terribly negative consequences that we've got. So I just, given the planning system that we've got, I would actually have a tax rather than section 106. Given the planning system that we've got, I'm perfectly comfortable with trying to extract rents from landowners But I would much rather see a world where we didn't artificially create those rents and we just did stuff through general taxation to fund all of those good policies. You know, it's difficult. I mean, actually, it's one of the things local authorities really, really love, you know, those that are actually capable of implementing it. Quite like Section 106, because it is actually a flexible source of resource to them. So, of course, they have reasons to say that they like it. But, you know, I would just like general taxation and sources of local income taxation that moved us away from needing to do all the Section 106 stuff. Also, partly because I just think that every developer I've ever met is in favour of Section 106 over any other more transparent means of taxing them, and that just scares the hell out of me. The developers favour it, surely we've got to be against it.
I generally agree with everything, so this is a bit that I'm critical of. It's the curve, that curve showing trade per square foot for retail. And an alternative explanation for it is, I think, this, that around the time, around 1990, suddenly the controls went off hours. And so you have to stay open, you know, 24 hours. You could stay open all the time. I can remember just before then, you know, being in you know, you had to be there before 5:30 because everything closed. You couldn't shop on Sunday. You know, and so I suspect that the sales per unit area is per square foot per hour or something like that, and not, you know, it's not standardising for time.
That's a very nice point. I shall communicate that back to Paul Cheshire. Because I think it's per worker, actually. But I will check that it is not per worker per hour. I'll tell them. That's a very good point.
Judith, one quick last one.
Yes, well, I have a bit of difficulties with related... when you related spatial policies and policies for people.
Uh-huh.
And you say, just leave it as it is, so people will move to the successful cities and everything's hunky-dory. And from your graphs, you can see that London is always on top, but the graph you just showed before this one again is, in fact, in relation to housing costs, London is absolutely not favourable, and you make this point yourself. Mm. So why should people then move to London? I think there are other forces at in play which make that you have fantastic pressure on London, despite this, the disparity between net pay and housing costs. So I would like to see some of those factors incorporated as well. Having skills or not is certainly one of them, but I don't think it's the only one.
Oh,
fun.
Hello?
Fun, yes?
It's fun. Actually, you can... loads of this is explained by me.
Do you have fun in Crawley?
Crawley, you can commute to London.
Get
that
into London.
Actually, I mean, Crawley, conditional on Crawley being Crawley, I would imagine that Crawley is a lot more fun than any other place in Britain that looks like Crawley but isn't located in London. Look, actually, I mean, what I didn't talk about today was that you can explain most of the differences here by going in and looking at amenities. I mean, what do I think explains the difference between here and here? Amenities. What do I think explains the difference between here and here? Amenities. I mean, I would just...